From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headley. New research from Emory University finds that going to church can improve your health.
I'm a Christian myself, so I believe it does make you happy, not just for the fact that religion does that, it's just the fact that you kind of find your purpose.
That's Andy Cardana. He's one of the folks that we met on the street to ask about going to church. Ahead this hour, we're going to bring in the expert to talk about how religious ceremonies might extend your life. But first, last week we talked about a controversial trend among Georgia's university students. Some people call it seeking an arrangement. Others call it being a sugar baby.
It's about finding a relationship with someone who actually wants to mentor you and gift you. And that takes time. It means putting in the time.
That's Brooke Urich, spokesperson for a website pairing college students with wealthy older partners. Relative to other states, Georgia is one of the top users of said service. And here are your first thoughts. Joe Costin of Hall, Georgia, writes us this email. I keep hoping this cannot be true. This is not right for anyone, male or female. It is sin. It is so damaging to people and life-giving relationships. And aside from the spiritual and biblical implications, there are practical reasons to not sin, no matter what your spiritual beliefs are. What about the emotional damage? Look at the future and think of what life would be like if a vast majority of girls and men lived like this. Well, we always want to know what you think, listeners. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OSTTalk, or you can email us like Joe did on secondthought@gpb.org, and we might feature your comments on the show. For more than 35 years, the Weather Channel has been on the front lines of some of the biggest stories in the world, literally.
Waves of water are already washing over parking lots in the greater New Orleans area. Some of the first signs of the approach of Hurricane Katrina.
The Weather Channel's live and continuing coverage of Winter Storm Grayson starts right here in New York City, where snow is catching in my beard here. I'm kind of turning into an icicle on the right side of my face.
Basically, the wind is really howling outside here, so it's hard to pick up any kind of a sound from the actual tornado itself. The whole north side of Birmingham has gone black, so they've lost power there.
Just a snapshot of some of the most dramatic storms in recent years as covered by the Weather Channel. The channel is, of course, based in Atlanta. You cannot miss it from the interstate. It was founded back in 1982 by meteorologist John Coleman, who died earlier this month at age 83. The Weather Channel continues to play a major role in shaping our understanding of our environment, of the weather, of climate. Dave Scholl is the Weather Channel CEO, and he joins me now. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Adam. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. This is before your time, but I wonder if you couldn't think back to the founding of the Weather Channel in 1982. What would have been John Coleman's original vision for it? What was the function of a 24/7 Weather Channel in the information economy of that time that was, of course, very different from the one that we have today?
Yeah, it was fascinating times. I mean, it was almost 36 years ago now, and so he was walking and trying to find a way to kind of get weather information out to the American public. And this is a time when CNN had just started and the cable systems were growing quickly. And so he had a vision of how do I get 24/7 weather information out there on TV? And, you know, I think his view was weather is this one story that impacts all of us. Yeah. In such a real and amazing way every single day. And people wanted to learn more about what was going to happen in their lives, whether it was going to rain or snow or, you know, what they needed to wear as they walked out the door there.
Yeah, people couldn't just look that up on their phone. It's just so hard to remember how different life was at that time. If they wanted to get up-to-date weather information before the Weather Channel, I suppose they just needed to watch their local TV news in the morning and wait for them to do the weather, which they still to this day do with some frequency, but you'd still have to wait for it. When I would have turned on the Weather Channel in the 80s, how different would it be from the Weather Channel today? Was it just like rolling weather, you know, just nonstop temperatures and precipitation in my local area and nationally, or like what was it, the sort of more story-based and interview-based format that I tend to see today when I turn it on?
Yeah, you know, I think it was much more sort of your daily forecast, right? That was the first thing that we wanted to deliver 36 years ago was here's what you need to know, here's your 5-day forecast, here's your 2-day forecast. John Coleman also had the innovation to make sure that was localized to you. There's a whole bit of technology that he really had a very innovative idea around, and so we had that technology going up early on. But, you know, what he was delivering on screen, he was one of the innovators around green screens and how to use the green screen to sort of provide the very, at the time, very rudimentary weather data, but then also sort of your daily forecast. And so that was pretty unique stuff 36 years ago.
Yeah. Liz Fabian is a reporter for The Telegraph in Macon, a very valued colleague of mine these days. But back in the early to mid-1980s, she was an anchor for the Weather Channel, and we talked to her about how she's seen that job change over the years.
The meteorologists now are more in tuned with broadcasting. When I first got there, I was really one of the only journalists on staff. Everybody else was a weather presenter or meteorologist. So the whole thinking and the whole evolution of what this channel was going to be has shifted dramatically as we see what's going on now.
Yeah, Dave, that makes me wonder, you know, what's the percentage of people who work at the Weather Channel who are trained meteorologists versus people who are just professional presenters of the weather? And I don't mean to say just in any demeaning sense. I suppose I am at this moment merely a professional presenter of news. It's a profession I value, but it's different from that of a scientist of weather, right?
Yeah, we think it's really important to have everyone who's on air actually be a trained scientist. And so we have 45 meteorologists on staff, and everyone that you see on air presenting the stories to you is a trained meteorologist. And that to us is really critical, right? We're here to tell the stories about the science behind weather. It's, you know, as you said, it's different than it was 35 years ago. You can get your daily forecast on the iPhone. But if you want to understand what's behind the storm, what's behind the science that's impacting the tornado, you want a scientist with some credibility to explain that to you. And we hope they're good on TV as well. We hope they're good storytellers. But they've got to be scientists first and foremost. So.
Yeah. Liz also told us that she thinks that in the years that she's watched the network grow, it really has changed the way that people think about the weather. This is what she said.
I always kind of laugh inside my head when someone's talking and they'll say, oh, well, yeah, we've got that high pressure system. And, you know, you expect them to start sweeping their hands in that clockwise motion. Or when they're talking about hurricanes and, oh, the most damage is going to be on the northeast quadrant or this and that. You know, you definitely are seeing that they're picking up from the meteorologists that are continually talking to them.
So it sounds like it's working.
I am thrilled to have the mission, and we're trying to make all of America weather geeks. So we'll embrace that mission. We'll for us, that's a badge of honor. It's great.
Sure. Speaking with Dave Scholl, he is the CEO of the Weather Channel television network based in Atlanta. Weather.com is also you guys, right?
Weather.com is now owned by IBM. So we sold some
of those. Oh, that's right. There was a split recently. do you have any relationship?
We do. We remain close business partners, but some of those data businesses are now owned by IBM as part of their Watson artificial intelligence initiative.
Weather Channel, as we mentioned before, founded by John Coleman in 1982, kind of a controversial figure for a few reasons. Coleman was a climate change denier, and the Weather Channel has, whether it wanted to be or not, been at the center of debates about climate change for a long time. Here is something that Coleman said about this subject on CNN pretty recently, 2014.
Climate change is not happening. There is no significant man-made global warming now. There hasn't been any in the past, and there's no reason to expect any in the future. There's a whole lot of baloney, and yes, it has become a big political point of the Democratic Party and part of their platform, and I regret it's become political instead of scientific, but the science is on my side.
Coleman, as we mentioned, passed away earlier this month. That's why we're not asking him directly right now about those comments. But David, it has been a documented thing that there is a pretty high rate of skepticism about anthropogenic climate change among meteorologists. I wonder, are these arguments that are happening in the halls a lot of the time? Is this a constant source of tension in the workplace at the Weather Channel?
You know, it's really not. We feel pretty firmly that we're a science channel, so we have an obligation to talk about the science. And for us, weather and climate are really no different. It's just a factor of time, right? Climate is just the weather over time. So as much as we honor Mr. Coleman as our founder and appreciate his vision and applaud his visionary status, We firmly disagree with him with regard to climate change. We firmly believe that climate change is real and it's man-made, and we have an obligation as a channel to talk about that and to share the science. We're not going to get into the politics. We're not going to preach to people, but we're a science channel, and we're telling the stories about science, and climate is part of that.
That said, Dave, you are on record as saying that you're not a big fan of the term climate change.
I'm not. I think the whole point here is for everyone to be talking from a basis of science. And if we get into a place where we're preaching at people, or we're using terms like climate deniers, or we're degrading people, it's not allowing us to have a debate where we're just talking about, here's the science. It's very simple. Here's what's changed. Here's what's happened to our world already. And here's why. And that, to me, is a very different tone of conversation as opposed to throwing political terms back and forth.
Sure. So what's your vision for the Weather Channel as it goes forward?
I think there's a real opportunity to make TV even more immersive, right? So Mr. Coleman had the vision early on to use the green screen in a creative way. Well, 35, 36 years have elapsed now. We're very focused on augmented reality and sort of immersive mixed reality. So imagine the possibility of Jim Cantore being able to walk around a tornado that we throw up in our studio. And he's able to do that, and he's able to kind of talk about a 3D model. We're able to use very, very different green screen technology now for him to basically walk into the weather anywhere in the world, and we can create it. We can recreate sort of the hurricane or the tornado using really high-end gaming graphics. And so the technology of what you can do on the TV screen is astonishing. And so we're all in. We think we're ahead of a lot of our sports colleagues and our news colleagues. And we think this is an amazing place to apply this technology.
How do you think that being based in Atlanta might have affected the Weather Channel over these decades? Has it put you in a better position to cover the kind of extreme weather that is particular to the South, for example?
Well, I'm a transplant from Denver, so I have to say it's been a bit of an adjustment to look at the difference in snow levels and how the cities respond. Yeah. But I've come to really love Atlanta. I think a lot of our viewers tend to be in the Mid-Atlantic, in the Southeast, and so they're very focused on certainly rain patterns and snow patterns and severe weather that impacts Atlanta. So I think our people live in it, right? We're not in other parts of the country, and so we're able to kind of talk to that.
I mentioned before that the Weather Channel's headquarters, it's right off the interstate. If anybody is driving near the I-75, 285 interchange north of the city, you can't miss it. It's really, really prominent from the side of the road. There was a plan announced a couple of years ago to build a new Weather Channel headquarters, and I think that at least as announced at the time, y'all were supposed to be there by now. Whatever happened to that?
You know, we've put millions of dollars just this year into new control rooms in that building there at 285 and 75, as you mentioned. So we're there for years. We've signed a 10-year lease on the facility, but I don't really see a need to move from that location. I love that location. It's accessible on both 285 and 75, and so we hope to be a prominent part of the Atlanta landscape for quite a while here.
That's Dave Shaw, CEO of the Weather Channel, based in Atlanta. Thank you so much, Dave.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Just ahead, a front row seat at a lunchtime drag show in Atlanta shall be yours on the radio. But first, there may be a surprise blessing that you get for going to church. I'm Adam Ragusa in for Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. Stick with us. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusa, and today for Celeste Headley. It's a new year, which means most everyone wants to be healthier. You could spend your time jogging, doing yoga, watching your caloric intake, or, turns out, going to church. New research from Emory University finds that regular attendance at religious ceremonies can improve one's health and lower mortality. With me now, the lead author on that study is Ellen Eidler. She's a professor of sociology at Emory. Hi, Ellen.
Hi.
Also along for the ride is Harold Bennett. Harold Bennett, chair of the Department of Philosophy and Religion at Morehouse College. Hi, Harold.
Hey, how you doing, friend?
Doing all right. Ellen, what made you want to research this topic?
It's not the first study that's shown an association between higher religious attendance and greater survival, but there was a data set. This is the Health and Retirement Study from the University of Michigan. That's a national study representative of the population of the United States. And it had a 10-year period of follow-up for mortality. And it had really good measures of other things we call the social determinants of health. So it was an opportunity to do really a better analysis than has been done previously.
Harold, what's your take on what you read in Ellen's research?
Well, I think of several things. On the one hand, I think there is something to be said about being involved in religious service and how that can add to one's quality of life and perhaps longevity. However, though, I am concerned about not just the business of being in a religious service as much as it is the communal aspect, the whole group aspect, and what happens with the group dynamics that may be the agents or may be responsible for persons perhaps having a longer level, being their lives just being extended. And I put that in parentheses, but I think it's that communal piece that's so important. There's a lot I could say about that. For example, I'll tell you why I'm concerned about that claim itself. Is that so often many of the things that can happen in a religious setting can actually happen in other settings. And so that's why I think the community piece is so critical to consider.
Indeed. And Ellen, to be clear, your research is merely proving the correlation between attending religious services and positive outcomes in health. You're not necessarily trying to argue any kind of causal factor, but if you were to argue a causal factor, what might it be?
Well, actually, we dug in that a little bit, and I would say Harold really put his finger on the important finding, because there were several ways that we looked at religion, but one of them, the one about attendance at religious services, that was the one that really had the big payoff. There was another question about how important is religion to you, and that didn't protect people from mortality at all. So kind of being in your head about religion, it has no protective effect on health. But the communal dimension that Harold mentions, that is really where the big effect was. And so we were able to find out maybe what are the characteristics of people who attend services more often. And we were able to find out in the Health and Retirement Study, just as many other studies have shown, that people who attend services more often are less likely to smoke cigarettes. They exercise more. They go more often for health screenings. And when you adjust for those things, it reduces the impact of just the plain out religious attendance measure. It reduces it a little bit. It doesn't eliminate it by any means. But if people who show up for services also smoke cigarettes less, they're going to have a better health outcome. And at the same time, getting to the communal dimension, we had some measures of social support. So people who attend services more often are also more likely to be volunteers in the community and for other organizations. And so often religious organizations give people ways to get involved. And so supporting others as well as being supported by them is another really important aspect of the social contact that comes with this participation part of it.
We asked some folks on the street what they think about this finding that religion could or practicing religion and being an involved member of a congregation could bring health benefits. And here's some answers from a couple of folks we ran into.
Hi, I'm Morgan. I'm from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
And I'm Arthur. I'm from Decatur, Georgia.
I could definitely see it making people be happier, yeah. I think it gives people a sense of purpose. Like, I have a lot of friends, like, for them, religion is really meaningful and it helps them when they're feeling down.
Kind of the same kind of thing. You can get some fulfillment out of it, especially if, you know, your life's not going the way you want it to. You can find some solace in it.
We also spoke with Andy Cardona from Kansas.
I'm a Christian myself, so I believe it does make you happy, not just for the fact that religion does that, it's just the fact that you kind of find your purpose. Yeah, and that's something that a lot of people has to find, like their reason why to live for, you know? It can be like your dog, it can be like studying, but just as long as you find what you're the best at. And I think that's what sometimes religion brings to people.
We're talking about new research out of Emory University indicating pretty clear correlation between attendance at religious services and positive health outcomes, longer life. With us is the lead author in that study, Ellen Eidler, professor of sociology at Emory. Also with us is Harold Bennett, chair of the Department of Philosophy and Religion at Morehouse College. Harold, I wonder if something very simple causal factor at play here might simply be that going to church, going to services, being involved in a congregation simply gets one out of the house. And as you get older, a lot of folks have fewer and fewer opportunities to get out of the house and get moving.
Well, I think you're on to something. And this is what I mean when I say you're on to something. You're identifying perhaps some other variables that we need to put on the table. Here's why I make this claim. December 2017, the Huffington Post published a piece, and it's a very interesting statistic that they quoted. In that piece that they published by David Briggs, it says that 59% of African Americans actually go to church 3 to 4 times a week, whereas 39% of Euro-Americans perhaps are going. In fact, maybe even smaller than that. But here's the thing that's quite interesting to me. The mortality rate for African Americans is significantly higher than that is for whites. So I'm thinking that there's got to be something else. Is it going out of the house, or are there some other kinds of things that might contribute to a higher longevity rate, life expectancy rate, or living longer amongst the persons who were surveyed here? Maybe there's an economic piece. And I think our author does talk about that just a tad. Perhaps there's an economic piece that's involved. Maybe there's something we'd have to consider some other kinds of factors that are other sociological factors that might do that. But getting out of the house, perhaps that's one. But I think there are some other things we might want to expose and explore.
Yeah, the bigger picture, Ellen, that I think Harold is raising here is that religiosity is something that is, lots of research has indicated, is strongest in a lot of places and in a lot of communities that actually have particularly poor health outcomes, probably as a result of poverty. So how do these factors intersect?
That is such a great question. And I'd really like to respond to the other one, too, about aging
I'm
getting
sorry.
Out of the house. But to take you the first one first, I think that that's a real important direction for future research. And this particular data set that we just took a first look at with this study is special because it has excellent measures of wealth and income and assets. Okay. And usually health studies don't have very good measures of poverty. But it's not just poverty, it's income across the whole spectrum. And the Health and Retirement Study specialized in those economic measures. So we'll be able to really look at that exact conundrum of why it is, and this isn't just true in the United States, that communities that have higher levels of poverty also are very likely to have higher levels of religious participation. But across the world, the poorest countries are also those with the most people saying that they are religious and most participation. And it's the rich Western industrialized countries of Western Europe and Asia that have extremely low levels of participation. So we know that these economic measures produce health outcomes, and we know that religion produces it. Figuring out how they fit together, to me, is the agenda for future research that I'm planning on working on. Is it okay if I come back to the aging question? Because that's really interesting, too. I teach epidemiology of aging at the Rollins School of Public Health, and I'm really interested in aging populations. It is true that older persons are more likely to attend religious services regularly. They have had higher rates of participation throughout their lives, and they continue them into old age. It's not like they get more religious when they're older. They just always were. Younger people are less religious and presumably will stay at a lower level throughout their lives, too. But religious participation offers a kind of social connection in old age that's really important. So Harold said, get out of the house. When people get older, they experience losses. They experience retirement and the loss of those connections that they had with their workplace. They may lose their spouse. Their children are older, may move to very distant places. So their social networks contract. But the religious community is one that's available in every community. And you, all you have to do is show up, and they're happy to see you, even if you've never been there before. Especially if you've never been there before, they'll be real happy to see you. So, yeah. So it's a voluntary social tie that's available in communities. And many congregations provide transportation and outreach. They reach out to their elderly members to help them come in. And I live across from an assisted living, and on Sunday morning, there's a couple of vans that show up from a couple of different churches, and the residents there are, they're lined up with their walkers. They're excited to get on the van. They're going to get to go, and there'll be music, and there'll be coffee and donuts, and there'll be little kids running around, and they'll get to be immersed in a very vibrant social world that is, it may be the only outing that they have all week. So yeah. I think you can't overestimate the importance of that, getting out of the house. That sounds like I'm just coping with boredom, but really it's a vital social tie. It really is.
Well, I suppose that raises a question, Harold, and I'll let you take this one. If, in fact, one of the reasons why higher rates of religious participation may be correlated, are correlated with better health outcomes, could it be just as could that be just as well achieved by being a member of a bowling club or a bridge club? Is it just about being a member of an extended social organization, or does the faith element matter here as well?
Well, I great question. Here's my response to the first part. I think that those outcomes, the business of healthcare, the whole idea of being able to get out and get involved and to engage in meaningful relationships, clearly that can be met in through other types of organizations. I would not say that the church has a monopoly on that kind of thing. Or shall I, let's make it, whether it's the masjid, whether you're visiting a synagogue, whether you're involved in a Buddhist community, however you want to classify that gathering that has some faith piece to it, I would say that that community that does not monopolize that type of experience. However, I think though there is something to be said about being involved in those faith kind of communities, because again, a lot of the networks you're probably a little more comfortable with. I think there might be even a little more a freedom to experience, have an authentic expression of who one is. I think in these religious kind of gatherings, people often have these life-altering moments where they are actually challenged with decisions that they have to make. And some of these decisions with which they're confronted could very well have to do with their health, with their mental well-being. And then other types of information could be distributed there that can help them get whatever it is they need. So to respond then, I think that there are other ways that these other needs and types of experiences can be had. However, I think that perhaps some of these faith communities, these theologically kind of oriented gatherings, do have something just a little bit special.
That's Harold Bennett, professor of philosophy and religion at Morehouse College. We were also speaking with Ellen Eidler, professor of sociology at Emory, lead author of a study finding a close relationship between religious participation and positive health outcomes. Thank you to both.
All right.
Thank you.
A restaurant, of course, can be more than a place to eat. It can also be a hub for friendship and for family. That's how many people feel about Cow Tippers. This Midtown Atlanta establishment has been a force in the city's LGBT scene for the last two decades. But earlier this month, Cow Tippers announced the end of an era. It closes February 18th. GPB intern Emily Bunker visited last weekend for a lunchtime drag show, The Heifer Review.
It was sad. This is a neighborhood institution for so long.
My parents used to come here.
Cow Tippers has always been somewhere that I've come to every time I visit.
They've got such an incredible group of people that has worked here.
A lot of us came on dates here.
It's always going to be a memory when you say Cow Tippers.
I get a little choked up thinking about it. I don't think that there is something that's going to replace this.
Amber Devine from Douglasville, Georgia. I'm one of the entertainers here. I'm just sad there's not more gay-owned restaurants, you know, that cater to the community and other people in the community. The favorite item on the menu is the Ruby Red. It's a hamburger named after our hostess, Ruby Red.
I have a burger named after me. How many drag queens has a burger named after them? For God's sakes. It's ridiculous. So I've made friends, like lifelong friends with people that I've just met sitting next to them at the bar having a cocktail. It's been an incredible ride.
My name is Damon Massey. I'm from Detroit, Michigan. I was a waiter and a trainer, and then I was a key employee. I learned a lot, not only about food in general, but I also learned how to build good friendships and long-lasting relationships.
Mitch Hamilton. Well, I used to live here about 17 years ago. In part, it's a little disappointing to see the Midtown area changing, where there's so many condominiums coming in and the locally owned businesses going away. Just the energy here is something that you don't find anywhere else in Atlanta, whether it's LGBT, a straight environment. You've really missed out on an opportunity if you've never been here.
Those are fans of the Atlanta restaurant Cow Tippers. The place was slated to close last weekend, but thanks to a spike in business, the owners tell us that Cow Tippers will stay open at least a couple more weeks. So you got a chance. Just ahead, reinterpreting the sound of blackness with artist Paul Stephen Benjamin. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. Last summer's chaos in Charlottesville raised a number of questions about Southern identity. An important one is, how do we look at and contextualize Confederate symbols? In Georgia, we have nearly 200 monuments that honor Confederate figures. Decatur, Athens, Rome, and many more Georgia cities display these statues and memorials and markers. Amid calls to move or demolish them, President Trump made this comment.
Was George Washington a slave owner? So will George Washington now lose his status? Are we going to take down statues to George Washington? How about Thomas Jefferson? What do you think of Thomas Jefferson? You like him? Okay, good. Are we going to take down the statue? Because he was a major slave owner. Now, we're going to take down his statue.
And we talked about all of this with Valerie Babb, professor of English and African American Studies at Emory University. She says that it may be worth it to keep them up so that we can understand them better.
What I think we're talking about is rethinking what those memorials represent, because they're not really about the past. They're more about our attitudes towards race and justice today. So I think people who are calling for taking them down probably are really calling for a reevaluation of where we stand towards our history and towards what those monuments represent.
And we want your thoughts as well. We visited a statue of an anonymous Confederate soldier in downtown Macon. Here is what Maconite Calvin Watkins had to say about that memorial.
Since I've been in Macon all my life, and he'd been sitting there, and I'm 74 years old. Well, for my part, really, I think it need to come down.
We also talked to Macon resident Lori Scott. She had a different opinion.
You can't change history, so what's the point of taking down the monuments? That's what history is. You see what happened in the past, so you prevent it from happening in the future.
Now it is your turn. We're collecting opinions about all the Confederate monuments in Georgia. Later this month, we'll spend a full hour discussing what those memorials mean to our state and what we should do with them. We need your input. Call us at 404-500-9457, 404-500-9457. Leave a message telling us about a Confederate monument near you and what you think should be done with it. You can also post to our Facebook or Twitter pages. We're at OST Talk, or you can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org, onsecondthought@gpb.org. Our next guest is not your usual gallery artist. Atlanta native Paul Stephen Benjamin does not typically use paint or canvas. Instead, he uses bits and bytes and pixels and screens, lots of screens. In an exhibit that you might see TVs stacked high, each with different images that may blend or conflict. Benjamin has a new show at Telfair Museum in Savannah. It's called Reinterpreting the Sound of Blackness. It opened to the public this weekend and is on display through May 6th. Paul Stephen Benjamin joins us now. Paul, could you start just by explaining or setting the scene visually? What do people see when they walk into this exhibit?
What you first see when you walk up the stairs is a 14-foot by 27-foot black flag. It's oversized, but it has the stars and stripes.
So it's just purely monochrome, black on white?
Yes.
And then what do you see when you walk past the flag?
And then as you go in to the gallery, you come across three of the works. Immediately, you are embraced by Aretha Franklin and Lil Wayne singing God Bless America on about 50 monitors stacked up.
50
pretty
monitors.
High. Yes.
What a dramatic sight. Fortunately, there is sound, too. The show is called The Sound of Blackness, and we can at least bring that part on radio. So here we go. Here is Listen to the Sound of what you were just describing. Two different renditions of God Bless America, one screen playing Aretha Franklin's version, another with Lil Wayne's version.
God bless America.
God bless America. God bless America.
God bless America. God bless America. God bless America. God bless America.
The Sound of Blackness, an installation, an art installation at Telfair Museum in Savannah right now by artist Paul Stephen Benjamin. What are you trying to say by juxtaposing these elements?
Not necessarily trying to say anything. What I'm really doing is this idea of collapsing time and space. I've asked this question with this body of work. If the color black had a sound, what would it sound like? And so in that, and not necessarily trying to answer that question, but investigating that idea. There are different things that I think people kind of associate with blackness, maybe the color black. And so I'm juxtaposing those things. I'm juxtaposing generations. So when people go into the exhibition, I understand that there's a generation of people who will not know who Aretha Franklin is. They will not know who Lil Wayne is. But they do know that song. And that song and the two of them singing that song, for me, it represents this idea of what America stands for the time period between 1977, when Aretha Franklin sang that at President Jimmy Carter's inaugural ball, and Lil Wayne singing that, I want to say approximately 2015. That time frame, that's what's important to me.
The exhibit also features a similar spot where people walking in amongst this forest of screens would experience two different versions of Strange Fruit, legendary song about lynching. The first plays Billie Holiday's version, the second plays Jill Scott's version. Let's listen.
Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze.
Black bodies swinging in the summer breeze.
In the summer breeze.
Black bodies swinging.
Black bodies swinging.
Paul, I imagine that physically navigating this exhibit could be very moving for some people and potentially even upsetting. What kind of reactions have you observed among people going there that you've found interesting?
Well, what's interesting is that over time, when I've done these, I've had, through social media, people reaching out to me, expressing different emotions. One young lady sent me a message and was like, I'm just sitting here crying. So, you know, it affects people in different ways. I understand that. My point is not to necessarily create a specific emotion, but it is to create thought and dialogue.
It's interesting. You describe the goal of your work, of your installations, as being one of using media to collapse time and space. And the first thing that I think of when you say that is how I kind of feel like that's how my life is generally these days, with the state of modern media and everything being at my fingertips. I feel like I'm constantly swimming in a sea of media. And I wonder if that's a comment that you're a comment about current conditions that you're trying to make through your work.
Yes, and that is a part of it. Most of the equipment that I'm using, particularly within those two installations that we talked about, utilizes TVs, the old TVs that basically are from the late 1990s to present. So I kind of think of the appropriation of these or the repurposing of these as they sat in someone's living room, dining room, whatever, or bedroom. And there is this history that each of them has. But each of those collectively tells a story. And that's how we, over the last 20, 30 plus years, that's how we see information. That's how we primarily receive it. Now, most people are accessing, or a lot of people are accessing, the internet. But it's still on the screen. There's less and less reading. But this is like one of the primary modes of how we get our information is through these screens, whether it's a telephone, whether it's our watches, how, you know, the way information is conveyed has changed.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost like having a set of eyes, you know, as part of an installation. It's there's not only the item there and the thing that it's showing presently, but there's also everything that has been shown through it in its whole history. And it's almost like it's haunted with that after imagery.
Yes. I mean, literally and figuratively. I mean, yeah. At the point now, there's even discussions where, you know, you can be seen watching your TV and getting your response.
Yeah.
It's a little too invasive for me, but.
That's artist Paul Stephen Benjamin. His exhibit, Reinterpreting the Sound of Blackness, is on display at the Telfair Museum in Savannah between now and May 6th. And you can see him lecture Thursday, February 8th at 6 p.m. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you.
Let's add a couple more tunes to our Georgia playlist. For this, we ask people to choose two songs that they think best represent Georgia. Two simple rules: nominations have to be songs written or performed by a Georgian, and artists cannot nominate one of their own songs. Today, we feature Meredith Hanscom from Athens-based band Neighbor Lady. Here are Meredith's picks for the Georgia playlist.
Hey, my name is Meredith Hanscom, and I play bass in an Athens band called Neighbor Lady. My first pick for the Georgia playlist is Nothing Ever Happened by Deer Hunter. It starts off just with a drums and bass, and it's like really drivey. It goes like that for a while with the guitar coming in. It kind of abruptly stops, and then the bass and the drums lock in. And they start again, and it sets the tone for the rest of the song. And then the thing that's really good about them is that it's really, at the end of the day, it's pretty simple, but the drums and bass are always really locked in. And the bass lines are really, it just has like a lot of attitude. This song, like, it really talks about being passive, how like when you're being passive and you're just kind of living your life on autopilot and you're just waiting for opportunity to fall into your lap, like nothing really ever happens. But Deer Hunter, just like their music speaks for itself. It's just like really captivating and trance-like, on top of it being, you know, really interesting ambient guitar and a lot of delay and reverb. And Bradford has really great airy vocals. I know that the stuff that is happening is just really like visceral, and it resonates with everyone. I think that Deer Hunter is one of the better rock and roll bands that come out of Georgia, in the way that they're not like blues inspired, and they don't have like southern roots per se. As far as in their music, it's not like a southern rock band, but it really just transcends all the stuff coming out of here, because they're just a really good band that can tackle a lot of genres in their music. And over the span of their existence, like in their catalog, there's just so much texture and depth, and they're just a really, really talented group. My second pick for the Georgia playlist is a song called Wire by Omni. I don't require a certain potency. Yes, I know it was before. So I think that this song really does capture Omni's style, because it has like movements within the song where it's one part that's really kind of like groovy and laid back, and then the chorus is really aggressive and guitar driven and rhythmic with a lot of stops and starts. And the best thing about Omni is that they have a lot of space within their music, and everyone in their band has a really like defined, distinct role. I think that Omni is a great band because in the past couple years, the Atlanta music scene went through a lot of change, growing pains, and I think that Omni is a really good example of how like people from a lot of groups can come together and do something really cool and unique and awesome. They really illustrate that less is more, and that you don't really even have to have more than a three-piece band to do something really cool and unique. Something I like about them too is that their songs are pretty short, and their songwriting is just very like they lay it all out there, and I really like that because you can almost like see what's happening as you're hearing it.
That was Meredith Hanscom from the Athens band Neighbor Lady. They perform at the 529 Bar in Atlanta tonight at 9 p.m. Have a song or an artist to nominate for our Georgia playlist? Call us 404-500-9457 and share your music picks. And for more Georgia playlists, visit gpbnews.org and click on the GPB Music tab. And that's our show for the day, but we want to know your thoughts on Confederate memorials. We will devote a full hour to them next week. Should we keep them, move them, destroy them? Why or why not? Call us, 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or reach us on Twitter. The show is at OST Talk. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea. Have a good one.